pal.
Hey there, I'm Pete Townsend, and this is Money Never Sleeps. We look inside the minds of entrepreneurs and at the crossover of startups, enterprise, finance, technology, and life as we know it. This episode of Money Never Sleeps is sponsored by Pat FinTech, the training partner that demystifies fintech and digital finance for financial services professionals. Owen Fitzgerald and I are back with another Money Talk segment this week. We get into the story of Stripe's latest investment round and what this means for Ireland. We look at Revolut's North American dream. We skip through the latest SPAC names and a whole bunch more on this week's episode of Money Never Sleeps.
Money never sleeps, pal.
Yeah, so I know that's actually a great point to start with Joey Tribbiani and Noodle Soup. If any of our listeners out there know anything about what I'm talking about when I say Joey Tribbiani and Noodle Soup, please drop me a line. Drop us a voicemail on our website, moneyneversleeps.ie. Yeah. Anyway.
You know how Mark Andreessen said that software is eating the world? Well, software ate this episode. Every now and again, the gremlins crawl into your audio setup and mess with your sound quality. And that happened to me when we recorded this earlier this week. I've edited it all down as much as possible. But please excuse my underwater sound for the next 30 minutes. We'll be back to normal next week.
Owen, bro, how are you doing tonight?
Good, yeah. Looking forward to having a chat.
Yeah, absolutely. This just kind of digs right into everything that gets you thinking about the things that you enjoy as part of your professional life,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Gives me the freedom to talk about these things.
Yeah, exactly. You do need that freedom. Anyway, digging right in, Stripe, our good friends, the Collison brothers. I met one of them at 3FE, the coffee shop in Dublin, about 3 years ago. He was showing a gaggle of students around the coffee hotspots near the new Stripe office. And anyway, Stripe hit big news last week. Massive new $600 million funding round at a valuation of $95 billion. And it was big news here in Ireland because the state, as it's referred to, the Irish state or the NTMA, National Treasury Management Agency, and yes, they do have that third name as well, the Ireland Strategic Investment Fund, right? So ISIF, as we call them here. ISIF invested $50 million. And it might have been you that I was talking about with this last week. It might have been someone else that was just kind of guffawed at it. You know, $50 million in a $600 million round as if it's chump change, right? In terms of the percentage they're going to end up with here. But still, I mean, it's a significant investment to be made. Now, who are they investing alongside? Well, some big names, obviously. Sequoia Capital have been in from nearly the beginning. But Allianz X, a big insurance company, Baillie Gifford, who are a Scottish asset manager, who kind of do invest a bit in private equity deals, which Stripe are now obviously a massive private equity deal. Fidelity, right? My old haunt, stomping grounds way back in the day. And so some pretty big names there investing in Stripe alongside. I'm sure a number of the other usual suspects who were in from the very beginning have followed on. Maybe not, but who knows? Take a look at Crunchbase and you can figure it out. Anyway, the big news in Ireland, people were saying, why did the state invest $50 million in Stripe? What is in it for Ireland with ISIF making this investment? So just some of the quick stats, just for those that don't know much about Stripe. They were founded in 2010 by John and Patrick Collison. The brothers were 21 and 19. I think Patrick is older. Patrick is the older Collison, I think. Now they're 32 and 30. They sold their first startup in 2008 for $5 million, then dropped out of MIT and Harvard shortly thereafter to focus on their startup, which became Stripe. Stripe processes 5,000 transactions per second. That kind of blew my mind when I saw that stat. This was in the Irish Times piece by Conor Kelly. Also, Stripe processes more payments each year than the entirety of global internet commerce when Stripe first started back in 2010, which is kind of mind-blowing. The biggest idea here, and this is kind of echoing some of the sentiment that our friend Shamath shared a few weeks ago on a podcast, Invest Like the Best, and we mentioned this before with Patrick O'Shaughnessy, where he said something to the effect of, take a look at all of the old school traditional financial services players that are valued in the hundreds of billions, if not into the trillions right now, right? Then have a look at fintech, which when you throw out Stripe, you throw out Coinbase, which, you know, may or may not be included in the fintech number, depending on the day of the week and what you're looking at. You've got maybe tens of billions. So there's so much room to grow in fintech in terms of the valuation. And if you look at what these fintech companies are doing, they're providing exactly the same, if not more, better, cheaper, faster services than traditional players. So there's so much more room to grow. Looking at the global payments market that Stripe are primarily a big player in, there is $240 trillion in payments globally, and only 14% of that global commerce happens online today. So just like the wider total fintech space, so much room to grow there. Okay. Another one was the, and this is the big one, obviously, for Ireland, is more than 1,000 jobs will be added by Stripe in Ireland. That, yeah, and they're referring to them as high-skilled jobs, right? And they're also supporting 10,000 Irish small to medium-sized enterprises in their global growth strategies. I don't know how they're going to do that. They're making, you know, if they're going to start a fund, but also supporting the University of Limerick Software Engineering Program. So it's big news. It's big news for Ireland, and one that may not have been picked up in the global press, right? With, yeah, it's a $50 million investment by the Ireland Strategic Investment Fund. But for, you know, for those of us here, it's a big deal.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, it's funny because you might think, or probably people outside of Ireland would look and say, 50 million in a 600 million round is nothing in the scheme of things. But that's because they're looking at it from a normal investment lens, whereas, you know, the state is investing for a return on jobs and, you know, the economic benefit of the state. They're not measuring it on, oh, will we get a 3x or a 10x on our investment? Yeah, they might end up getting that. But the reality is that, like, you could look at it and say, well, potentially that 50 million is guaranteeing 1,000 jobs. So in the scheme of things, then it's more than worth it. You know, actually, they'll end up at a cost per job. It's very little in that respect. So, you know, we have to bear in mind kind of the metrics and the measurement and the focus of the state's investment here. And you see it in other countries as well. And look, I obviously know a bit about it, given my current role. But, you know, that's it. Helping embed Stripe here in Ireland. And, you know, there was a really interesting piece. We're talking there about some of the stats around Stripe. Like, to me, Stripe are kind of funding and driving the internet businesses of tomorrow, or of today and the future, you know. But at the same time, they're incredibly US-centric. Like, they're in 42 countries. The majority of those actually are across Europe, and they've made some really interesting acquisitions in Africa. But actually, in terms of their wider product offering, it's currently only kind of focused in the US, you know, in terms of Atlas and I think Radar and the issuing stuff. So if you can imagine, they're helping to build or kind of fund in some ways or help scale internet businesses. And are purely, they've made this progress just in the US alone. So this kind of funding round and everything that goes with it will all be for the future European and African growth. So I think there's huge potential to scale that by rolling out just some of the additional products. I think it's actually the scale of the opportunity that still exists. Like, you talked about 14% there, but realistically, you know, what they're doing is integrating themselves as a very important product to help grow businesses. And then they're layering the products on top of that. But at the moment, that's currently only focused in the US. You know, you're able to set up your Delaware company and you're able to kind of incorporate, and then they have the compliance product as well. And they're currently only US focused. So once they start rolling that out now, you know, they're in 42 countries. The acquisitions, the really strategic acquisitions they've made in Africa, and then just layering on the products, you become that key piece of infrastructure then for so many businesses. So, you know, I would argue that nobody is going to be laughed at for putting 50 million or even more than that into Stripe currently, despite the incredibly high valuation because of the potential scale of it.
It's a credible investment that ICIF now have on their roster of investments, which means it's going to get some attention, right? Which is a good thing. If they're just investing 2 or 3 million, obviously, why would you do that in a big 600 million round anyway? But if you're investing 2 or 3 million, and it's like corporate VC, right? I think it's like you said, in corporate VC, do they really care about whether that is for 2% of the equity or 10% of the equity? It's not going to really move the needle in terms of the global P&L of a big company that has revenues in the hundreds of millions, if not billions. So with corporate VC, it's really more about who are you going to assign internally to look after that investment that you've made? How many investments can they look after, and how can they report all the innovative activities that they're involved in back to their board to say, we're going to bring value from this investment we made back into the company, right? Back into the corporate. So it's kind of the same thing here, right? It's what value can this investment that ICIF have made bring back into the corporation that is Ireland, right? So I think that that's kind of the thought process here. There was a term going around a few years ago with a few of the folks I was working with referring to as double bottom line impact, right? And where ICIF not only invests obviously directly into companies, but most of the investments, if you check out their website, and I'll put it in the show notes, are in funds, right? So in private equity funds and venture capital funds, if you look at the list, they've invested in Motive Partners, which is a fintech venture capital and private equity fund out of the US. Frontline Ventures, Atlantic Bridge, Silicon Valley Bank, they've invested in. They're here in Ireland as well. MML Private Equity, who just did a big deal in Ireland in the funds industry with DMS and a couple of others. Insight Partners, they've invested in Insight Partners. I did not know that. And the Irish Whiskey Growth Fund, you know, which would be one of my favorites. So they're making lots of investment. The whole idea, when you're talking about this double bottom line impact, and the folks I was working with a few years ago tried to pull one of these off, right? And say, all right, listen, ISIF, you write me a $20 million check for my private equity fund. And because I am a private equity fund manager, I have some influence over the portfolio companies themselves. And I may be able to influence them to move some of their high growth technology businesses to Ireland and operate out of Ireland. So you write me a $20 million check for my private equity fund, and I promise you that I'll try and get some companies here to create some jobs as well. In addition to that, I will set up an office for my private equity company here in Ireland, and we will create jobs that way. So that double bottom line impact. Right. And in addition, beyond my existing portfolio companies, it may be somewhere else in the world that I may be able to influence to move to Ireland. I can also make investments in Irish companies and obviously create jobs. Right. So it's a wonderful story to be able to do this at the fund level. But to me, it just seems a lot more straightforward when you're doing it at the company level. Right. There's a lot less companies on the investment roster of ISIF than there are funds, just because it's a different type of investment that you're doing. So yeah, that was the big news for Stripe this week. Any other thoughts on that?
No, the thing that comes to mind and has been around for a good while and will continue to be asked is when or do they go public? And if so, when does that happen? Because, you know, the guys tend to be a bit cagey about the answer to that. But you could argue that the moves they've been making, like adding Mark Kearney to the board, I believe they have brought in a new CFO who the previous company they'd been with, they'd brought public. So it seems like they're putting all the right players in place to do that. But I suppose is that the right move for them? I don't know. At a certain point, you'd have to imagine they have to go public.
Yeah, they absolutely do. I mean, it's kind of like they're on series, and I will say that the American way, H instead of H, and not much comes after H. But if you're at 95 billion valuation, you are one of the most valuable pre-market deals there. Going public, most of the time it is saying, listen, we want to be able to use our equity, our stock to finance our own growth, right? And do that through the public capital markets. So they have a lot of room to grow. So I'm expecting they can accelerate their growth through their own equity in the capital markets a lot quicker than doing another, $600 million.
Stripe is fairly squeaky clean. There's no question marks over it. Like, I know Robinhood had been looking at IPOing recently, and there's still talks about that. And, you know, we've had other companies kind of pull back from it because of question marks over business practices or other things. So whereas, there's nothing. There's no negative. I don't see the downside to them going public necessarily, other than obviously the added regulatory burden and being a publicly listed company and the reporting. But like you said, there's the ability to just build up on almost day one that massive war chest. Like I saw, and I must find the report, they're one of the most active investors in the fintech space themselves. I think they have 31 or something companies that they've invested in, strategic investments. So even the opportunity to build that war chest significantly to do more of that investment / acquisition play in terms of being able to scale, you would think, I don't see the downside to doing it.
No, I absolutely love it. I think it's, I love it when I'm seeing a technology company kind of knock down the barriers of inefficiency of financial services. And they're doing an incredible job of that. Speaking of players that are trying to knock down the barriers in financial services, we have one that was in the backyard of our friend Stripe in the US, and they were upstairs to the north in Canada. So Revolut had set up shop. It didn't take off. They couldn't really crack the big four. So they pulled out of Canada, and they have now applied for a U.S. banking license. And this is actually, they're applying in California. So it's a California Department of Financial Protection and Innovation. And they can get an independent bank license from the state of California, which would allow them to provide services, I think, across the U.S.
No, I didn't pick up on that piece.
Yeah. So I think that is something that they're going to be able to do. So in terms of regulation, what they have already in the UK, they're an e-money institution and they have an application in for a full banking license. In Lithuania, which is near and dear to my heart because I have some family heritage going back to Lithuania in the early 1900s. Yeah. Yeah, little known facts about me tonight. And they have a special banking license in Lithuania that allows them to operate across the EU. Anyone who was in Ireland recently, your bank details, your IBAN after Brexit changed for Revolut from a UK IBAN to an LT IBAN for Lithuania. And already got a few eyebrows raised over that. Like, what's this LT IBAN? What does that mean? Where's that from? It's like Lithuania. Don't worry about it. Like, okay, fine. They're currently operating in the US under someone else's license, a metropolitan bank or something like that. So if they can get this, they can then start with their ambition in the US of this fintech super app. Yeah. That I've been hearing recently that they've referred to a few times. They've been referred to as a fintech super app. I didn't think they were a super app yet. They're no WeChat.
But I know they made an announcement at some point last year. I must find it. I had it open on one of my tabs. You know, Revolut 7.0 or something. One app to rule them all. That was the way they'd phrase it. They're planting their flag that's what they're going for. Yeah, time will tell.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to need to do a lot in the U.S. They'll need to do a lot in the U.S. besides what they're doing right now, because Revolut, to most folks, while we were all still traveling, it was really about FX, right? And you could very easily move money around, could very easily spend in multiple currencies when you're traveling. You get that little ding-ding that goes off when you land in Amsterdam that says, you know, you just flew from London, would you like to buy some euro, you know? But in the U.S., FX isn't a big thing. Right? Because you've got 300 some odd million people that are all spending US dollars, and that's pretty much it. There's a very small proportion of people in the economy that actually need FX services on a regular basis or need the ability to send money all over the world in different currencies. Right? People forget about the migrant population, which our friend Ollie Walsh would come and school us about. Shout out to Ollie Walsh from Pipit. And that, you know, there is money flow going from Canada to the US, from US to Canada, from the U.S. to Mexico, from Canada to Mexico, from the U.S. down all over LATAM in a bunch of different currencies. So that's one thing to think about here with regards to Revolut. Would they be able to provide that type of, you know, could that become the, hey, you move to America, you get a Revolut card, right? Now, I'm sure Ollie Walsh would rather say, hey, you move to America, you start using Pipit, right, from another country. But I think they're going to have a hard time, like Monzo has had a hard time, because you have these native digital banks in the US that are already scaling, right? Everyone in Ireland that just Revolut's money to each other, you know what they do in the US?
Venmo and Cash App.
Exactly. So I'd love to know what they're thinking about the US and where Nikolai Strongsky goes.
Yeah, I don't think, if you think about Revolut and Monzo, like, and N26, you know, they were able to scale in Europe, you know, fairly common market, but also lack of competition. Like, who are they competing with? The banks. You know, it's a far different ballgame. Aside from it being, like you said, that one big market of 300 million people, you know, there are some serious players there. You know, Revolut's trying to go into a market. We talked about Square recently, and Square looking to become a bank, and Cash App, and I think 30 or 40 million users on it. You know, you're talking about Venmo. Like, I think the only way that they're going to crack a market like this is to go down the route of some large acquisition of an existing kind of customer base. I think the spend alone of trying to, you know, get your name out there to compete with the likes of Cash App or something, it's just not going to work. They're not going to be able to compete. They're coming over as a foreign player into a market that already has some very big names. I think the opportunity, if it's going to be one at all, is to acquire even something like a regional bank with, you know, a few million customers. What we'd consider a big bank in Europe, but is probably a smaller player in the scheme of the US, but maybe has that regional element to it, where it might still have tens of millions of customers.
I'm thinking insurance for some reason. Someone that already has a significantly large customer base on a digital-only business, right? Where you don't have some huge integration cost, get rid of all this stuff you're going to acquire with it being a paper-based regional bank of an old-school traditional player. So big, big player from another segment that will allow them to significantly move towards the super app status. So yeah, you heard it here first, folks. Revolut to acquire an insurtech player.
Like, Walmart is a far better position than Revolut to be the super app. Like, hugely. 220 million people going through its doors every week, you know, and they're trying to integrate solution to their app. So yeah, you're probably spot on, actually. Someone who already has a lot of the other offering, but doesn't have the front end banking / payments / FX offering, and they want to integrate Revolut into theirs. And even if it becomes a rebrand and Revolut seems to be the front end of it, the front facing piece of it, maybe that's the play. or it's a tech company again who has all of that, like the way you might have Apple Card and, you know, but it's backed by Goldman Sachs or whatever. Maybe it's a play like that, whereby it's a tech company that needs the banking piece of it. And that's who they're partnering with. I think that's the only way they're going to get to scale over in the US.
Okay. See, I knew talking to you, you'd come up with something.
Yeah.
Or we'd come up with something together. Because it's like, I'm sitting here thinking, Jesus, what the hell are they going to do in the US? You talk it out.
And I mean, we could start charging for this stuff. If Nikolai or any of the guys, well, you could. I can. You can start charging.
Yeah, no, I can. And they can pay it into my Revolut personal account by mistake instead of my regular business account. But speaking of more craziness in the US, it's the SPAC. It's all about the SPAC attack. It is the season of the SPAC, as reported by CoinDesk. I'll give them props for that. Trading platform eToro to go public through a $10 billion SPAC. That was reported by TechCrunch last week. Don't forget, they're an Israeli company. For some reason, when I think of eToro, I think of Texas. Yeah. Toro, which means bull in Spanish. I don't know. And there's more horses than bulls in Texas, I presume, but who knows? They are, through a merger with the FinTech Acquisition Corp 5, the combined entity will have an implied equity value of about $10.4 billion. I'm a big fan of eToro. I logged in a couple of years ago and opened up an account. The whole social trading element of being able to watch what other people are trading and pick these high-flying portfolios and just follow them, right? And they were one of the first ones to make that available for crypto strategies as well, which was pretty interesting and kind of, you know, putting their back up against Robinhood. So let's see what happens there. Also backed the cryptocurrency exchange, which is backed by the Intercontinental Exchange. There's also a name for them has been brought up as a potential SPAC merger later this year. Kraken, the first crypto bank, with their bank charter from the state of Wyoming. They are considering a direct listing as well in 2022, according to CoinDesk. It just seems like a very, very popular route to go. I don't know why people hadn't thought of this earlier.
This episode of Money Never Sleeps is sponsored by Pat FinTech, demystifying fintech and digital finance for financial services professionals. Pat FinTech enable financial services professionals to transform their capabilities into the digital age with dedicated virtual training programs geared towards those that can develop, deliver, and monitor optimally customized user experiences balanced by appropriate governance, control, and oversight. To learn more about Pat FinTech, go to moneyneversleeps.ie/PATFinTech.
What has been the difference where you can go out and raise money for a shell company now? Is it just because there's so much more dry powder out there in the economy?
I think there's an element to that, yeah. Like with anything else, once one of the big names, and I think it was Airbnb at the time, talked about doing a direct listing, like once it started to become something that, you know, the bigger players started looking at seriously, well, then all of a sudden others were starting to think about it. Then there's all the dry powder, like you said, that's available there. And there's the appetite, clearly, in the last year and a bit, of retail investors. Everyone wants to bet on the stock market now. So why wouldn't you go public in whatever way? Like, presumably a SPAC is the quickest way to list now, or a direct listing. You know, there's no roadshows, there's nothing. You can pretty much just kind of turn it around very quickly, and all of a sudden you're there to be actively traded. So there's probably an element of not wanting to miss out on the gold rush of interest from retail investors. Like, we're talking about in the US alone, like, people were getting their $1,400 checks last week or something, you know, and so much of that was probably going into crypto and into retail investing. So
I know I was waiting for the bump on crypto the last couple of days and it didn't happen. But yeah, there is just so much money out there. It was $24 billion that was projected to go into crypto out of the stimulus checks, or even the first round of the stimulus checks, that people were just going to dump it in there, which is totally the antithesis of the federal government sending a bunch of money out to people so they'll spend it in the economy, right? Buying stuff so that to help, you know, pay taxes.
You know, anyway. Prior to COVID, you know, there had been a number of kind of high profile listings whereby, you know, the fees generated by the investment banks were enormous, but the initial market response was fairly lukewarm, to say the least. You know, it was quite negative over the first couple of days. I think Facebook had a very rough kind of first week, you know, and it raised questions about what are the investment banks doing, you know, because, and then you've obviously, there's been lots of pushback on, you know, market prices and being set in the days before, and then all of a sudden it's opening way higher and stuff like that, you know. So I think, you know, there was starting to be that lack of trust in the banks and the advisors on some of the, like, the typical kind of IPOs, you know. So this is a way to just cut out that piece of it.
They're you know, taking a cut on a wealth transfer
yeah.
is all they're doing, right? You know, doing all the road shows. There's work in that, obviously. There's a lot of resources that the big investment banks put into this, and they do it very well. They do it very professionally. They get the whole trading book going, everything, right? A lot of heavy lifting to do. But at the end of the day, do you really need that? For the longest time, it's expected that you do, but I don't think you do, right? And the market will pay what the market will pay for something. And if, you know, an investment bank wants you to go in at 45 and the market says, hey, we're going to open it at 65, then wonderful. But the investment bank wants you going at 45 and the market wants you to open up at 25, well, the hell, you know, you just paid a bunch of fees and you've lost a bunch of money unless you did it your way, did it yourself. But Jesus, I'm sure if an investment banker that was doing an IPO was listening to me right now, he'd be shouting down the phone, you got it all wrong.
They're welcome to come on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Please do. Please do. But I like these types of things that challenge the institution, that challenge the old guard. So I will be, you know, forever in support of it. But anyway, a couple of other interesting things that happened. So I will put this in the show notes. This is just a quick one, Owen. The Square Crypto Book of Bitcoin Mythology, shared by Jack Dorsey. Who else on Twitter? Where else?
I didn't say that
last week. And this just kind of tore apart some, in a very friendly kiddie storybook type of way, all of these myths around Bitcoin, around it hogging up all the energy and using too much electricity for mining and so on and so forth. Yep. And it just ripped it all apart.
Okay.
So little educational thing there. A couple other quick things I just wanted to mention. I did a Sunday Clubhouse with Ajit Tripathi and Aman Kohli last week. And I was sitting there posting up something for the podcast on a Sunday afternoon, and I saw my phone buzz. Okay, these two guys I know are in Clubhouse. They just started a chat called Boring Sunday. It was Mother's Day. I probably should not have been on my phone for this. But I open it up, and they're like, Pete, how can we talk? And I'm like trying to get my earphones in, trying to figure out what's going on. So I did get off the phone 10 minutes later. But for the 10 minutes I was talking to them, I think it was Ajit was saying to me, so Pete, tell me what you're up to these days. I said, I'm messing around with DeFi a little bit. He then went into probably a 2 or 3 minute treatise on what is DeFi and what is not. And then my daughter came knocking on the door. And she was in tears. So I got off, but I never got to finish that conversation. To hear more from Ajit, which I really wanted to know, was his view on DeFi and what was and what was not DeFi. Was that rooted in some type of purist view on the whole crypto space? Or was that actually, the key point is for DeFi to be true DeFi, it needs to meet the D criteria in the word, which is decentralized, right? If it's not decentralized, it's not DeFi. But I think there is an element of DeFi that is, now I won't even go there because it's too late for me to start explaining. A lot of the sentiment that's come out of this over the last couple of years is that why the whole digital asset space, the whole cryptocurrency space has been able to go mainstream. It's because of the earliest players that have decided, well, what do we need this business to look like? And what do we need this product to look like so that it can be adopted by institutions, right? And so they've evolved, you know. So
that's what the ironic thing probably is, that it's taking institutions getting actively engaged now with Bitcoin to normalize it, to make it more accessible and accepted. But yet that probably goes against the principle of the whole thing.
It does. It does. And it's crazy that I'm listening to the All In Pod experience this morning, thanks to Niall Dennehy. Shout out to Niall Dennehy from ATEC, who was one of our first guests on the show way back in 2018. And I had seen mention of this All In podcast, but I forgot about it. But it is the besties,
it is
as
really
they call
good.
Themselves. Jason Calacanis. Yeah. Calacanis, Chamath, David Sachs, and David Friedberg. They're gambling buddies, right? And it makes a lot of sense. They're talking about gambling. They're talking about rubbing two cards together to get a hand, right? And they're all placing bets. Right? They're all angel investors or, you know, bigger fund investors. But anyway, they're not stumbling over a crypto conversation, but they're having a very elementary crypto conversation, which is like, okay, that's what we were talking about 5 years ago. And I think one of them, I think it might've been Friedberg or Sachs, was kind of leading the conversation down a slope of trying to be educational about it. And I'm like, some of the most intelligent people in venture right now are having that kind of a conversation. Okay.
Yeah, I know. It's mad.
And I kind of mean that with a positive and a negative to it, in that, you know, these guys then move on and start talking about all these other deep concepts about quantum computing. And I'm like, I don't have my head around that. I can't talk about that stuff. But you know what? They're investing in this stuff. And that's why they know about it. And that's why they learn about it. They're not investing in crypto, right? They're not investing in the next frontier of money. And, you know, shout out to whether it was Friedberg or Sachs, but one of them said, listen, a lot of the naysayers out there are those that have missed a trick. They don't understand the technology. You know, the Warren Buffetts of the world, the Charlie Mungers of the world, Janet Yellen, whomever, there is a missing link to their knowledge in the way that they speak about and push back on this whole space because they don't understand the technology. If you don't get it, you can come up and follow all the sentiment around, oh, Silk Road, drug dealers, blah, 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 blah. Right. So, yeah, I'm not going to talk about that.
No, that's not.
But listen, the rant over. I know you wanted to announce one thing that we're doing.
Yes, we're in the background on new logos and branding with a view to getting out, well, some new logos specifically. I mean, we put our creative brains together back in 2018 and came up with a logo that we're happy with. But thankfully, we've got some outside help now to pull something together for us. Shout out to Jill for helping us out. But yeah, we wanted to, I suppose we've always been trying to get to a point where we've got some really cool merchandise and branding and, you know, building out the name and the brand around it. So that'll be all launched this week, or has been launched this week, by the time this goes out on Friday.
Absolutely. I absolutely love the branding. And yes, absolutely. Shout out to Jill. Like I said, some of this reminded me of a cross between Dropkick Murphys and Fenway Park, which, you know, that hits me right in the soft spot. This episode, when it goes live on Friday morning, as you folks will be listening to it, you will see the new logo up on all of our social media postings. So anyway, we'll see. But no, really excited to have that going on. It's going to be nice to be able to have it consistent looking
like stuff to start wearing it.
Yeah. Yeah. The baseball hat. Absolutely. All right, buddy. We'll leave it there for tonight.
Take it easy.
That does it for this week, folks, and you can learn more about the stories we covered in the show notes on our website, moneyneversleeps.ie. So check us out online and subscribe to our weekly Money Never Sleeps newsletter as well. Also, thanks to Conan Brophy from CreateSound for mixing and editing this episode. Conan is an excellent media man to get in touch with when you're thinking about launching your own podcast. As for me, I'm the founding partner of Norio Ventures, and I'm an early-stage startup advisor and investor focused on fintech and digital assets. If you'd like to talk to me about your business, drop me a voicemail on moneyneversleeps.ie. Finally, till next time, thanks for listening. See ya.